You are listening to the Forgotten News Podcast.
But before we begin, here are a few words about a couple of other podcasts that we think you might want to try.
Everyone has been staring the whole time.
Well, yeah. Didn't they tell you?
That I'm the most powerful lightning mage this place has seen in years? Yeah, Professor Sumner maybe mentioned it.
Bryn Tessick, Photomancer Class 6, Umbramancer Class 5. I'm here to challenge you to a duel.
So you're saying she's had practice?
I'm saying she's had training. I don't think we're looking at the late bloomer here at all.
A week ago I was a normal girl, and 3 days ago I didn't think I'd ever have to worry about magic. All I want to do is fade into the background and get this over with.
Alexomancy, a fantasy adventure podcast. Check us out at www.electromancypod.com.
You're talking about me like I'm some kind of revolutionary.
That would be a dangerous thing to say. And an even more dangerous thing to be.
In 2005, I was gifted a bound collection of letters that would, in many senses, change my life. It was over 100 pages of handwritten letters from the late 1980s between a landlord and two of his tenants. The letters are, at first ridiculous, then insane, and then, ultimately, too insane to be believed. And that's where this podcast actually begins, because those letters would send me on a 15-year investigation to find the truth about the letters and the people who wrote them, if they ever actually existed. That investigation would force me to ask myself a lot of questions. From the comedic, like, whose responsibility is it to replace dead fish at a rental? And how exactly does someone break a refrigerator with a leg of lamb? To the philosophical, like, who owns a story? When does nonfiction become fiction? And how are we as consumers responsible for the blurred line between the two? The Karen and Ellen letters are equal parts mystery and comedy. It's a deep dive investigation into both found writings and humanity. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll Google endlessly, and you'll laugh so hard you cry. You'll hear the actual letters, along with my 15-year journey to get to the bottom of them.
Welcome to the Forgotten News Podcast. This is your window to hear true stories from long ago. Stories that once made headlines. Stories that people thought would be unforgettable. Yet those stories were soon lost in the sands of time or were buried deep in the dustbin of history. In this podcast, we shake off the sand and dust from those stories and share them here with you, as fresh as the day they were first told.
And now, here's your hosts.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome to episode 72 of the Forgotten News Podcast.
This is Jim.
Hi, this is Kit. Hey there, listeners. Well, just like we promised on the previous episode, it's been less than a month, and we're back. Yay!
Hey,
I'm pretty excited about that myself.
So, with that being said, let's just can the small talk and just bounce right into our featured story.
However, we are first going to tell you about a few things in the story that might be too upsetting for some members of our audience. So, in that way, you can decide for yourself if you want to continue to listen or not.
Our featured story on this episode revolves around the very strange kidnapping and disappearance of a child, approximately 77 years ago in Oklahoma. And for various reasons, this incident became enormous national news at the time, and again, very unexpectedly, in the 1990s. So, listeners, if you are of a nervous or sensitive disposition, or get frightened easily, we advise you, calmly but sincerely, to simply turn off this episode now.
In addition, we do not recommend this story for children under the age of 14, since it could easily be scary for young ears.
So if any little sponges are nearby, please use headphones or earbuds, or simply listen later when you're just by yourself. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Our feature story will be told by a wonderful guest narrator.
She will be identified shortly after the end of the story.
So, with all of that having been said,
on with the show!
Our story begins on April 9th, 1947, in the town of Woodward, Oklahoma, a community of about 5,000 people at the time. On that date, at about 8:30 p.m., the town was slammed by a massive tornado that was moving with wind of approximately 296 miles per hour. This disaster was made even worse because people of the town had received no advance warning on account of a strike by the workers at the telephone company. So, the people of Woodward were absolutely shocked to suddenly see this 2-mile-wide tornado which tore through the town and destroyed everything in its path, including over 200 city blocks and residential areas. As a result, the community was almost obliterated. Nearly 200 people were killed, and over 1,000 were severely injured. It caused over $5 million in damage, which, in the present day, would be nearly $60 million. However, the Woodward tornado is remembered not only for all of the death and destruction, but also because of a very strange mystery that happened in connection with the event. A man named Hutchinson Croft was a successful sheep farmer. He was a well-known man in the area. And, for some unknown reason, his nickname was Olin. He lived in Woodward with his wife Cleta and their two children, Joan Gay, age 4, and Jerry, age 8. The tornado crushed their home and killed Cleta instantly. Olin was badly injured, but the kids, Joan Gay and Jerry, were only slightly hurt. These three survivors were brought to the Woodward Hospital. However, since they weren't in need of emergency care, the two girls were sent to wait in the hospital's basement while the doctors and nurses looked after those in need of urgent help. The two girls fell asleep together on a cot. Then, later that night, two men wearing army-style clothing came into the hospital basement, saying they were friends of the Croft family, and they were taking Joan to Oklahoma City Hospital, where relatives were waiting for her. One of the men picked her up, and Joan Gay shouted that she didn't want to leave her sister all alone. The men told her not to worry, because they would be coming back for Jerry. The hospital workers believed these statements by these men. It apparently sounded plausible under the circumstances, and the doctors and nurses, overwhelmed by the dozens of injured and dying tornado victims, were probably too busy and too tired to ask more questions. The men, who apparently looked like rescue workers of some sort, were allowed to leave with the girl. But shortly after Joan Gay was taken away, Olin's sister Ruth was told that her brother's name was listed in the local newspaper as being among the dead victims. She rushed to the hospital to try to find her nieces and take them to her home. When she got there, she was told that Olin was actually alive and would soon recover. He had been confused with another man with a similar name who had died in the disaster. However, when Ruth went to the hospital basement to check on the girls, Jerry told her what had happened to Joan. But when Ruth called Oklahoma City Hospital, she was informed that Joan was not there, nor had she ever been transferred to there as a patient. Ruth was now filled with panic. She called all nearby hospitals, as well as the morgue and an orphanage. Joan Gay was at none of them, nor had she ever been. The police were called and investigated as thoroughly as they could, but were unable to find any trace of the girl. The case received widespread publicity, but it was as if Joan Gay and her kidnappers had vanished into thin air as soon as they left the hospital. No one ever saw Joan Gay again. The FBI and Oklahoma State Police launched an investigation, but discovered exactly nothing. It has been a complete mystery from 1947 to the present day as far as the identity of the two men in army-style clothing, or how they happened to know that the Croft girls were in the basement of the hospital, or why Joan Gay was specifically targeted for abduction. Over the years, there have been many women that have publicly stated their belief that they were Joan Gay. But these claims have all been proven to be mistaken or false. Some were outright fakes, simply looking for money or fame. And others were simply people who just had never fit in with the family who raised them and thought they looked like Joan Gay based on childhood photos. But all of them turned out to be wrong for one reason or another. In the year 1993, there was a huge flurry of people who claimed to be Joan, or who believed they were Joan, after an episode of the TV show Unsolved Mysteries, which featured a segment about the disappearance. Incredibly, there were almost 500 women who contacted the show to say that they thought they might be Joan. However, all of these claims were quickly disproven by DNA testing. Much later, in the year 2016, the Oklahoma State Police sent the family DNA to a national database for testing, in hope of finding a positive hit. But, unfortunately, there was nothing and no one. However, unfortunately, all of this takes us back to the original mystery. Who took little Joan Gay Croft? And why? But if you have any concrete information as to what happened to Joan Gay Croft, the Woodward Police are still looking for answers and would be happy to hear from you. The phone number is 580-254-8535.
And that is the end of the story of the kidnapping and disappearance of Joan Gay Croft. Now, listeners, there is no one who knows what actually happened to Joan Gay, but there are a few theories. For example, one theory begins with the fact that her father, Olin, was one of the richest men in the county. According to some sources, he might have been the most rich man in that part of Oklahoma. So there are some people who believe that the men who took Joan Gay had originally intended to hold her for ransom. But after the police and FBI got involved, they changed their plans, and they either raised her as part of their own family, or they sold her to some unknown couple that wanted a child but were unable to conceive.
There is also a theory that Joan Gay might have been taken by men who were working for a woman named Georgia Tan, who ran an unscrupulous private adoption agency that literally grabbed random children off the street and sold them to the highest bidder. Now, there are some other theories that have cropped up over the years, but these seem to be the most plausible.
And that brings us back to where we started. Specifically, that no one really knows what actually happened to Joan Gay Croft. So, on that note, we will move on to our next segment. But first, we want to thank our terrific narrator for the excellent job that she did in telling the story. So please, just step up to the microphone and tell our listeners all about yourself.
Hey, I'm Meadow Hemphill, and I'm an amateur voice actor. I am 24 years old, and I've been voice acting for a little under a year at this point. If you like anything that you hear or you're interested in me potentially helping out one of your projects, just shoot me an email at Meadow, Wren, W-R-E-N, Hemphill, H-E-M-P-H-I-L-L, @gmail.com. I promise I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Thank you. You were amazing.
You were totally awesome. Thank you so much.
And with that being said, we will now move on.
Yes, it's time for Police Blotter and Court News. Now, if you are a regular listener, you will know that on this segment, we typically feature short stories or maybe a dozen or so crimes that were committed by obscure, small-time crooks or other random people, and whose name ended up in a newspaper column after the local court issued a ruling in regard to their case. But every so often, we shake things up a little, and we dedicate a Police Blotter segment to just a single story, rather than a dozen or more.
Although it will still be approximately the same length as a typical regular Police Blotter segment.
Our column on this segment is taken from a much longer story that was published on September 27th, 1908, in the Sunday Star, which was a newspaper in Washington, D.C. at the time. However, please be aware that this Police Blotter segment will be a little different, a little unusual, because the story will definitely be something that you won't expect.
Mainly because one of the key people in the story isn't obscure. Actually, he's a pretty famous historical figure. The crime at the center of the story is the thing that's obscure.
Now, with all of that having been said, Here we go.
Police blotter and court news.
On March 5th, 1872, in Washington, D.C., William West, a police officer on horseback, was on his regular patrol on 13th Street, when suddenly he noticed that a carriage was rushing down the street at an extremely fast rate of speed. The officer was immediately worried that the driver was either drunk or had lost control of his horse. He feared that the carriage might hit a pedestrian or possibly another carriage at an intersection. He was especially concerned for the safety of women and children. So, he quickly chased after the driver until he caught up several blocks away. He then yelled for the driver to stop and pull over. The officer then went over to the carriage. He was absolutely shocked to discover that the driver was Ulysses S. Grant, who was then the President of the United States. The officer then explained his concern for the safety of the public. In response, Grant apologized and explained that he had been cooped up in his office all day and had decided to go out for a drive to get some fresh air for himself and his horse, and that he had just gotten carried away. The officer decided to just give Grant a warning to drive more safely in the future and to obey the speed limit. Then, the two men simply went their separate ways. That is, until a few weeks later, May 6, 1872, when police officer West once again spotted the exact same carriage racing down 13th at a breakneck speed. This time, the situation was much more dangerous, because the street was busy with people, horses, and other carriages on their way to one place or another. Officer West definitely hoped that it wasn't President Grant, but someone else who had just happened to have the same type of carriage. But when he caught up, he quickly discovered that it was Grant once again. Grant said that because it was an especially nice day, he had decided to give his horse a little workout, but he didn't realize that he had reached an unsafe rate of speed. However, this time, Officer West decided he couldn't let the situation go with just a warning. So, he mustered up his courage and put Grant under arrest for breaking the speed limit and for driving dangerously on a busy street. President Grant then went to the police station with Officer West. He was booked and paid a $20 collateral bond, which allowed him to leave. He was also given a written notice of a date for a court hearing approximately 30 days later. Grant did not object to his arrest, nor did he claim any sort of presidential immunity. He did not complain, nor did he demand to speak to the officer's boss. Instead, Grant believed and understood that even though he was the president, he was not exempt from the same laws that apply to all other citizens. However, on the day of his trial, Grant chose not to appear. This was actually a very common occurrence in traffic cases during that era. But, as a result, he forfeited his $20 bond and was also fined $20 and court costs for his violation of the speed limit. The combined amount is the equivalent of approximately $1,000 in the present day. President Grant mailed a check for payment as soon as he received notice of the amount. Interestingly, William West was one of the first black men to become a police officer in Washington, D.C. He served in the position for over 35 years until his retirement in 1907. West had previously been a soldier in the U.S. Army during the American Civil War during the years 1864 and 1865. So, ironically, during that time period, he had been serving under Grant, who was then the commanding general of the U.S. Army.
And that is the end of our police blotter and court news segment for this episode.
And even though it wasn't what we typically feature on this segment, we hope you liked it anyway.
Now, before we move on, We would like to thank our narrator on the police blotter segment.
Hold on. There was one other voice besides the narrator.
Oops. Sorry. Now, please, take a moment, step up to the microphone, and tell our listeners any little thing that you would like them to know about you.
Hey, y'all. I'm Kelsey Olivieri from Durham, North Carolina. I'm an IT professional by trade, but my real passion lies in being an actor and singer, as well as dabbling in songwriting and playing guitar, piano, and banjo. I've been fortunate to have been cast in several podcasts and audio dramas with individual producers, as well as KCNV 95.1 Radio Story Hour. I'm the only Kelsey Olivieri on SoundCloud, so you can check me out there. I'd love to hear from you.
Hey there, I'm Erin Summonsby. I'm a voice actor specializing in animation, audio drama, and narration, with experience editing audio and video. If you need a voice for your next passion project, let me make it my passion project too. I can be contacted from my website, summonsbyproductions.com. That's SUMINSBY productions.com. Thanks for listening, and hope you enjoyed.
Excellent job. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That was absolutely wonderful.
Now, listeners, we would very much like to be able to tell police blotter stories from the 19th century newspapers of your city or town.
So if you have the time and ability, just send it to us by email, and we promise to use it as soon as we can.
The address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
Next, with that out of the way, we will move on to our recommendation and advice segment. And on this segment, Jim and I will each give a suggestion to you, our listeners, that we think might enhance your life in one way or another. And on this episode, I will go first, followed by Jim. So on this recommendations and advice segment, I'm going to recommend a new series that is on the Discovery Channel called America's Backyard Gold. It's a really interesting concept. Dave Torin, he travels around the United States and helps prospectors who, you know, gold mine on a non-commercial level, and he helps them figure out different things, so like, you know, maybe helping find more gold or something. But it's just a really interesting concept, and I do know a couple of gold miners who are going to be on it, so that's really exciting as well. So I think you should definitely check it out.
My recommendation on this episode is going to be two movies. One is a serious story. The other is lighthearted. Both of them are available on the Peacock streaming service. The first one that I will mention is Oppenheimer. Now, I know that it won a ton of awards this year, but I put off seeing it until last week because I was afraid it would annoy me for one reason or another. But quite the opposite happened. I was pleasantly surprised. The movie tells the life story of Robert Oppenheimer, who led the effort to create the atomic bomb. I was very impressed at the skill of the filmmakers in recreating the time period of the 1940s and the massive mobilization for victory by every means possible to defeat the Nazi menace in World War II. It also examines in detail the time period a few years later when Dr. Oppenheimer became a victim of a vicious smear campaign in the 1950s by jealous scientists and ambitious politicians. However, one thing that I didn't care for in the movie is a really pointless and unnecessary sex scene, which is filmed basically in the nude, and it's done in a way where it's like some sort of weird false memory or weird recollection that Oppenheimer is having, and it adds nothing to the movie. Personally, I think the movie would have been better without it. Now, if you are looking for a movie that digs into the morality of using the atomic bomb as a weapon of war, well, that is not this movie. And it probably would have ruined the story if this movie had done that. So, I don't think of that as a flaw. But with that one important aspect being taken into consideration, I strongly recommend the movie Oppenheimer. Now, from the sublime to the ridiculous, I am going to recommend a movie that came out in 2022. The movie is called Lola. But you need to be careful about that year, 2022, because there are some other movies with the same name. Now, here is the thing about this movie, Lola. First, it is also a movie that takes place during World War II. But this one is a fantasy. The story is like this. Imagine that two obscure young women who are amateur, self-taught electrical engineers, somehow they create a device in the early 1940s that is able to capture broadcasts from the future, from both radio and TV. So, in this way, they are able to warn against imminent Nazi military attacks, saving thousands of lives. And not only that, because of their device, they are able to bring some rock music of the 1960s into the 1940s, where they become a hit. But, unfortunately, one of their military warnings has an unexpected side effect that ultimately leads to the defeat of Britain and the establishment of a pro-Nazi government. This drives the women to search for a way to reverse everything that they had created. Well, that's the story in a nutshell. I'm not going to tell you any more about Lola. Instead, I'm just going to urge you to see it for yourself. And that is the end of the recommendation and advice segment for this episode.
But listeners, if you have a suggestion for something that you would like us to mention on this segment, just send us an email, and if it's a good recommendation, we'll pass it along to our audience. Now, moving along, listeners, this episode is being released in March, and in case you don't already know, March is Women's History Month. So, in recognition of that, and in keeping with the historical theme of this podcast, We will now present an episode of an old-time radio series called Behold, a Woman, which featured stories of notable women from history, both famous and obscure. This episode was broadcast on April 28, 1950. And here it is.
Behold a woman. Her perfume is a headiness in my nostrils. Her daintiness is a gladness in my eyes. Aye, the love of a woman is the true haven of man. This morning, we want you to behold a woman, seen through the eyes of John Archer, as he sits in the music room of his hilltop home looking west to the Pacific. Behold a woman, any woman, all women. Good morning. The sunlight slants over the keys of my piano and on the broad bosom of the Pacific over the edge of the hills. She's tranquil today, the sea. Deceptively tranquil, but she does not fool me. I put too many years dancing attendance on her moods. I know they are many and quick changing, like the moods of a woman, for the aspect of woman is endless. When you walk into a room for the first time, do you look first at the titles of the books? Do you pride yourself that you can tell the character of the owner by his books? Then perhaps you can tell me, who was Anne Lang? What manner of person was she? I never met her, for she died long before I was born. I have only part of her library for clues. Books picked up at a shabby stall on the Thames embankment. Here they are, dozens of faded, torn paperback novels. The titles are stilted and amusing, and the pen drawings on the covers of hoop-skirted women and mutton-chopped men take you instantly back to another day. A day when the young Victoria ruled Britain's land with her beloved consort Albert. On the flyleaf of each tawdry romance, in faded childish script, is written...
This book belongs to Anne Lang.
You think you know her? She read trash and penny dreadfuls. An apple-cheeked scullery maid? Perhaps. A bit of the human flotsam that surges and struggles for a meager existence in London's teeming slums? Who was Anne Lang? Perhaps the most surprising thing about her is that she could read at all, yet here among the cheap and shabby paperbacks is a strange thing. A book of poems, leather-bound and gold-edged. Obviously worth much, much more than the purse of a scullery maid could afford. Let's open it. There's a bookmark from the Library of Buckingham Palace. And in a regal hand on the flyleaf...
Some services can never be fully repaid. May this token, dear girl, ever remind you of the gratitude of your queen. To Anne Lang, from Victoria Regina, October 4th, 1839.
What service had Anne Lang, the scullery maid with a head filled with impossible romances, have performed for her queen? I have searched the history books in vain. They tell me nothing. I have only the trashy novels, the elegant volume of poetry with its regal inscription, and, of course, beneath the queen's signature, the awkward scrawl once more.
This book belongs to Anne Lang.
Who was Anne Lang? Of all the instruments I play, the organ will always be, I suppose, my first love. My mother, rest her soul, had great plans for me once. It was her fondest dream that I should someday become a fellow of music at Oxford, and in time, be knighted as first organist of St. Paul's, which means, of course, first organist in the kingdom. Not an easy dream to realize, and one that will, I'm afraid, never come true. But I never cease thanking my mother every time I draw out the gorgeous sound of this king of instruments for daring to dream magnificently. All mothers, of course, dare and dream for their children, boldly or modestly, according to their lights. Nancy Hanks was a humble woman, and she dreamed humbly. She died when her son, Abraham Lincoln, was 9 years old.
If Nancy Hanks came back as a ghost, seeking news of what she loved most, she'd ask first, "Where's my son?" What's happened to Abe? What's he done? Poor little Abe, left all alone. Except for Tom, who's a rolling stone. He was only 9 the year I died. I remember still how hard he cried. Scraping along in a little shack with hardly a shirt to cover his back. And a prairie wind to blow him down. Or pinching times if he went to town. You wouldn't know about my son. Did he grow tall? Did he have fun? Did he learn to read? Did he get to town? Do you know his name? Did he get on?
If Nancy Hanks came back as a ghost. I knew a woman once who rented her guest room to a ghost. You see this? An old plaid carpet bag. It's empty now. You don't see things like this anymore. But before I tell you about that, I must read you something delicious. Do you know the definition of a witch? There are two meanings to the word, really. First, a witch is an ugly and repulsive old woman in wicked league with the devil. And second, a witch is a beautiful and attractive young woman in wickedness, a league beyond the devil. Ah, but of the ghostly tenant. It happened in the last place in the world one would look for such a thing. In a neat suburban house, one of a long row of houses exactly like it, from which the husbands poured each morning to catch the 8:14 for the city, while the wives in neat print cottons lingered over a last cup of coffee before clearing the breakfast dishes. The little wife in this house was having a tragedy all her own. She had waked up quite suddenly to the fact that her husband was not the same courteous, considerate, adoring swain she had once fallen in love with. He wolfed his breakfast, he grunted when she tried to make conversation. He never noticed what she wore anymore, or the new way she was fixing her hair. Luckily, they were the kind that could talk about these things to each other, and that night she upbraided him.
You used to pay me all sorts of attentions. Now you hardly know I exist.
He protested, of course, but darling, I do love you as much as ever. It's only that somehow I don't seem to have the time. Business. Business, indeed. That led to a quarrel, all right. Until they both, being sensible people, realized what they were doing, and the quarrel dissolved in laughter and kisses. Maybe, the husband suggested jokingly, we should advertise for a ghost, a perfectly charming ghost, to pay you all the little attentions while I earn a living. He could stay in the guest room. They left the matter there, but the next day the doorbell rang.
Good day. I heard you have a guest room to rent. My, what a charming way you wear your hair.
Somehow, she couldn't have told how, for the life of her, the stranger established himself in the guest room. An old plaid carpet bag was his only luggage, but he was dressed impeccably that night at dinner. He held her chair as for a queen. He conversed wittily and laughed at her sallies. He complimented her on her gown and her cooking. The contrast to the treatment she had been getting from her husband was a very marked one indeed. And when her husband objected to taking her to the theater, the stranger quickly offered to escort her. Before long, he became an indispensable part of the household. At first, the husband was rather relieved. But one evening, he picked up the papers he had brought from the office. Good night, dear, he said briefly. I'll work over these reports in the den. He gave her his usual absent-minded peck on the cheek. The stranger laughed.
Call that a kiss? Now here's a real kiss.
The husband was vaguely troubled as he worked on his reports. The next night, he beat the stranger to it and held his wife's chair. The stranger stepped aside. And from then on, each time the husband volunteered a gallantry toward his wife, the stranger gave way until finally the little wife made a discovery.
Wife, he's gone. He's been gone for days, and I haven't missed him.
It was true. Only the little plaid carpet bag that had been the stranger's only luggage remained in the guest room. And the next day, the bag, too, was gone. Possibly to the guest room of another suburban house in another suburban town. Who knows? What's that? How did I get hold of the old plaid carpet bag? Ah, now, there are some questions you shouldn't ask. The dominant male. You know how dominant he really is. As a matter of fact, 127 male children must be conceived to every 100 girl babies to make the male and female population come out even at maturity. Yes, who's so rugged now? Something borrowed, something blue. Cold hands, warm heart. There's not one of us that doesn't have a touch of superstition inside. They'll always be with us, superstitions. Our forefathers had them, and new ones are continually sprouting from the people. If you wander among the Ozark Mountain folk, here are some of the signs and portents they will tell you true. Don't marry in rain or snowy weather. Unlucky. If you burn your cornbread, your sweetheart is angry at you. If you have a cobweb over the door, that means he will never call again. Grain of wisdom in that one. If a red bird flies across your path, you'll be kissed before the night. And if you stub your toe, a sweetheart will appear within the hour. When a damsel's skirt flies up or her stocking falls down, her lover is thinking about her. Well, he is if he's there to see, that's sure. And here's a special beauty hint. For those annoying freckles, apply rainwater caught on the 1st of June. You may have to wait several years before it rains on the 1st of June, of course, but don't worry. The freckles will still be there. Yes. I seldom play this Celeste now. It's over 100 years old, and its tunes are very fragile. But it still has many a gay, happy melody in it. It was given to me by one of the most wonderful women I've ever met. And I've met many wonderful women. The Countess Fabrizi, over 80 herself, yet straight as a ramrod, for all she walked with a cane. She knew her own mind, and she loved good food. I met her only once. I came to the garden of her villa on a strange mission. It was in Martinique. She lived almost directly under the dread volcano Pele, which a century ago snuffed out the lives of 500,000 people in a single day. She greeted me.
Ah, Mr. Archer, it is a pleasure. So few visitors I have nowadays. And very few such handsome men. No. First dinner in the arbor beside the fountain here. Then business. I must show off my Pierre, the pride and joy of my declining years. No one makes a clear turtle soup like Pierre. Oh, and wait until you taste his omelette au fine herbe. Ah, heavenly. I inherited Pierre, you know, when my cousin Nicholas died.
But, Countess, it is about your cousin Nicholas that I am here.
So? A tragic loss. But that happened some years ago.
True, madame. You remember there was some doubt about his death at the time, a talk of foul play.
Gossip, nothing was proved. Nicholas slipped on the stone staircase of his house and fractured his skull in falling. Who would kill a harmless old man? Yet, they even suspected poor Pierre. There was no evidence, but merely because Pierre was the only other person in the house...
I beg your pardon, Countess. Evidence has come to light since. Read this letter, please.
Huh? It is Nicholas' handwriting.
Yes. And notice the date.
April, the day he died.
Yes.
Dear Augustine, I am very much afraid I shall have to get rid of Pierre. He cooks divinely, but he has the temper of a fiend. And I am really in bodily fear of him. The other day I became so irritated at his conceit and obstinacy that at last I threw a cup of coffee in his face. I laughed at his threat of killing me and thought the whole thing would blow over. But he scowls and mutters in a highly unpleasant fashion, and several times I have fancied he was following me as I walked. Well, may I ask where you got this letter, Mr. Archer?
A friend of mine appointed me executor. I found it among his effects.
Have you shown it to anyone?
No. But, Count, what are you doing?
I am burning it. There. Farewell, Cousin Nicholas. Rest in peace.
But, madame, I don't understand. You're shielding a common murderer.
A common murderer, perhaps. But a very uncommon cook. Ah, dinner is served.
I wonder how Pierre would have got along as an army cook with the recipes of the field ration manual.
Peel, wash, and dice 6 bushels of potatoes. Add 1 bushel medium-sized onions, 2 pounds salt, 350 pounds of fresh ground sirloin.
Sounds delicious and very filling. Listen, a great heart is beating. Throughout his tragic life, Ludwig von Beethoven longed for love, for the haven of a home, and the comfort and companionship and adoration of a woman. His face was ugly, his manners gruff and forbidding. Yet a woman loved him. A woman saw through the harsh exterior to the burning light within. A woman always will. Who was the immortal beloved? Giulietta, Teresa, Bettina? He never named her. We have only his letters.
My thoughts go out to you, my immortal beloved, now joyfully, now sadly. Oh, God, why is it necessary to be apart from one who is beloved? Your love makes me at once the happiest and the unhappiest of men. My life, my love, farewell. Oh, continue to love me. Ever thine, ever thine. Ever for each other.
Ever thine, ever thine. Ever for each other. Yes, the aspect of woman is endless. Woman is the lift of an eyebrow and the curve of an arm, the glint of a jewel on a living breast, and the hint of an elusive perfume, now present, now gone, the quickening of a pulse and the faint, far-off song of a bird. Woman is all this, and how much more. Who can truly say he has ever fathomed the heart of a woman. Behold a woman. She is God's creature. This program is a Carlton E. Morse production featuring Michael Raffetto as John Archer and written by Lawrence Goldman. Your announcer, Dresser Dahlstedt.
We hope you enjoyed our special presentation of the April 28th, 1950 radio broadcast, Behold a Woman.
And on that note, we will now move on and share a few important things that we would like you to know about in regard to the podcast.
First, we absolutely love hearing from you directly. So if you have any comments, suggestions, or other feedback, simply send us an email to forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
We are also on Facebook and Twitter. Just use the search feature and you'll find us.
Now, listeners, just in case you might want to contact and interact with me personally, well, you can. I am on X, formerly known as Twitter. My handle on there is @KitKaren. And just to make your life easier, I will now spell that for you. @KitCaren. I also have a page on Facebook. You should be able to find it by using the Facebook search feature. Just be careful, because there are a few people with similar names. There is also a link in the show notes, in case you get totally lost. Feel free to give me your comments, compliments, or criticisms on Twitter or Facebook in regard to anything on today's episode, or the podcast in general, or me. I am always completely open and willing to hear from any of our listeners. Just don't be salty or mean or creepy. So if you follow that one simple rule, I promise that I will respond. So, do we have a deal?
Now, Listeners, as we've said on previous episodes, we truly like hearing from you.
We honestly mean that. We really, really do. So please feel free to contact us through any of the ways that we've mentioned.
And with that being said, it's time to wrap up the episode.
No, there's one more thing. Remember, history is no mystery. Dum dum da dum dum la 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 ba ba bum bum bum. This episode was recorded before a live audience of
us.
Bye, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the Forgotten News Podcast. You will now be returned back to the present day, and we hope that we can count on you to join us for our next episode.
The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existence.